I'm going to talk mostly about the Environmental Defense versus Duke Energy case, which was just argued November 1, and sort of through that, use that as a lens to talk about the challenges of environmental litigation. I gave a similar talk just this past weekend to the Southern Environmental Law Center's board meeting, the 20th anniversary annual board meeting. So if it sounds a little preachy, it's because I'm sort of in the mindset of giving it to donors and not necessarily to students. So I'm going to try to tone it down a little bit, so I apologize if it gets a little too much rah-rah SELC. Well, the gist of the case is a series of enforcement actions that the EPA began in December of, really in 1999, and then in this case in particular in December of 2000, over a core program of the Clean Air Act called New Source Review, or commonly called NSR. I don't know if you've all, have you taken environmental law yet or are familiar with NSR case? Well, then I'll give you a brief rundown of what NSR is as a program. In 1977, Congress went through a major program to amend the Clean Air Act. The modern Clean Air Act was born in 1977. They amended it. And one of the key programs that they added was this program called NSR, or New Source Review. And the gist of the program is that, and the, or as it relates to this particular case anyway, is that new power plants, when they're built, have to install modern pollution controls. But industry at the time said, wow, that's really, really expensive. We can't retrofit it on all our old plants. And Congress said, yeah, you're right. It is too expensive to retrofit. So we'll give you a temporary grandfather. But when you modify those plants, and that modification increases pollution, then that's going to trigger NSR, that's going to trigger New Source Review. And at that point, when you modify the plant, you're going to have to go ahead and install modern pollution controls. And what happened was, for decades, plants went through what they termed in their own memoranda these life extension projects or plant modernization projects. Plants would come off for months or sometimes years at a time to go for these massive multi-million dollar overhauls. Not just maintenance projects through their regular annual budget, but massive capital projects that they would raise the money for specifically to fund these massive overhauls. And throughout all these overhauls, they never once complied with the requirements under the Clean Air Act for New Source Review. So EPA, looking around in the late 90s, saw that there were all these plants that appeared to have violated the New Source Review provision and began what they called an enforcement initiative in a series of cases around the country. This case was filed in December of 2000, and it's literally as the Clinton EPA people are on their way out the door. It's sort of one of the last ones that they get to file before the end of President Clinton's term. And so they file this case, and they essentially hand it all over to the incoming Bush EPA people and say, here's the case, you guys prosecute it, we've got it all teed up for you. Not surprisingly, the Bush EPA has a slightly different view of NSR. 9 days into President Bush's term, he creates the Cheney Energy Task Force, which was charged specifically with looking at on two issues on New Source Review. First question for the task force was, should we continue forward with these enforcement actions? And they raised some questions about whether we should. And the second question that the task force raised was, if we are going to, regardless of whether we continue with the existing enforcement actions, we need to reconsider the regulations that these enforcement actions are based on. Basic little point of how the Clean Air Act works, obviously the standard is set in the statutory act, but it's up to EPA to pass the regulations to put some to meat on those bones and give it meaning. And so they said, we need to reconsider those existing regulations. Well, when that happened in 2001, that sort of raised a red flag to the folks at the Southern Environmental Law Center. I wasn't there yet. I was clerking at the time. But the concern was that EPA is not going to vigorously enforce this case. In the Duke case in particular, this was 8 coal-fired power plants, 7 in North Carolina, 1 in South Carolina. A significant air pollution problem for states in our region, for the Southern Environmental Law Center. So we went ahead and thought we need to intervene in this case to be at the table to make sure the case is enforced all the way through. And that's really a key strategic decision in if the issue is the challenges of environmental litigation, as an environmental group, you don't have a lot of resources to throw around. You don't have a lot of options in terms of where you're going to get involved. You have to be judicious about using your limited resources. So the decision to get involved here is in some ways a scary one, because EPA is already prosecuting the case. Do we really need to be there if it's not going to make a material difference? Is there other places where we could, because if we're going to take this case, it means there are all these other cases we're not going to get involved in. So is that the best choice? And the theory was, if EPA backs out, we need to be there, and we can't choose to come in later. We have to be there right at the beginning. So that was the strategic decision, and we did it with this case, and we did it with another case that EPA had brought in Alabama against Alabama Power Company. That case is still going forward as well. Anyway, the gist of the legal crux in this case is over what it means to be modified. As I said earlier, Clean Air Act triggers these pollution controls if you modify an old power plant. So the debate becomes, what's the modification? Well, the Act just says modification means any physical or operational change that increases the amount of pollution emitted. So in this particular case, there's no debate. Everyone agrees there's been a lot of physical changes going on. They've overhauled these plants. So the question then comes down to, what does it mean to have an increase in the amount of pollution emitted? Because if you don't increase pollution, then new source review is not triggered. And industry's argument, as it's been all along, is that you look to the hourly rate of pollution, sort of to put it in the simplest terms possible. In other words, what we care about is the kilograms per hour of pollution. So if I've got an old power plant and I overhaul it and I actually make it more efficient and it reduces its hourly rate of emissions, then I haven't increased emissions and I don't trigger new source review. I've got a cleaner plant from the industry's perspective, or I've got a more efficient plant. Our contrary argument is, well, these old dilapidated plants that you're rehabbing, they were severely run down. They were, in your own terms, dangerous and unfit for operation. More than half of the time, they were down for maintenance and couldn't be in service. So when you overhauled them, you not just improved their efficiency on an hourly rate basis, you dramatically increased the hours that they could operate annually. So we say the key issue, amount emitted, looks at the real world amount of pollution in the atmosphere. You need to use an annual amount emitted test. In other words, let's say you've got an old coal-fired power plant that is chugging along and it's offline half the time of the year. You renovate it, its hourly rate doesn't change, but now you're able to operate it 100% of the time of the year. You've doubled its annual emissions, even though you've done zero to affect its hourly rate of emissions. So that's sort of been the crux of the issue. Are you going to use this hourly rate test, or are you going to use this annual rate test? And the issue is, are the regulations clear on this? And if so, which test do they prefer? There's also an interesting sort of jurisdictional argument here. These regulations were promulgated by EPA back in 1980. And the Clean Air Act has a section on judicial review that specifies that if you've got a problem with the regulations, you have to challenge them in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and within 60 days of the regulations being promulgated. The idea being, we don't want this sort of scattershot of everyone challenging the regulations in every different court they can find over however many countless number of years. We want it all done in one shot, everyone all together. We'll have a big developed administrative record from the rulemaking procedure, and we'll figure out what the rules mean in one shot. So it says you got to do it within 60 days in the D.C. Circuit. And it also says expressly that you can't raise as a collateral defense in an enforcement action a challenge to the meaning of the regulations, or a challenge to the regulations themselves, rather. So one of the issues that we raise is that essentially what Duke is arguing in arguing for an hourly rate test here is the regulations say tons per year. They're essentially challenging the meaning of the regulations, and that's something they had to do 26 years ago in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. They can't do it now in this enforcement action. And that raises sort of interesting questions that I'll get into in a second under how aggressively do you enforce that judicial review limitation. It's also an interesting one from the environmental group side. And it's something, you know, when a case like this ends up going to the Supreme Court, you get a lot of feedback from other groups that you've partnered with in the past, national groups who are involved in similar cases around the country. They're concerned they don't want your case to set bad precedent for their cases or future cases. And one concern that was raised as we were discussing this was if we argue as the Southern Environmental Law Center representing environmental defense, if we argue for a vigorous enforcement of Section 307, which is this judicial review provision, and say Duke Energy lost it, they had to challenge it way back when, and there's no reason why they should be exempted from that requirement. The concern raised was you could easily see an environmental case being flipped where an environmental group sees a regulation that they think is a good regulation, years go by, and the agency then enforcing that regulation adopts an interpretation that the environmental group thinks is completely undercutting the meaning of the regulation. And we want to bring a challenge, and the argument would be thrown back in our face, no, if you wanted to challenge it, you had to do it back in the D.C. Circuit 60 days after promulgation. So it's sort of this nuanced of trying to recognize there might be some due process concerns, there might be some just general equitable fairness concerns. How vigorously do you argue on 307? Anyway, we get to the Supreme Court, and let me tell you a little bit about the team and how this case worked. And it might give you an insight into how public interest environmental groups, or at least the Southern Environmental Law Center, works. We were interested in getting involved in this case, as I said, back in 2001. But SELC is not what's commonly referred to as a member-based organization. We don't have, like the Sierra Club does, thousands of members that, you know, send their $50 in every year and get the magazine and are considered members. Our money comes almost exclusively from either large major donors or from foundations and grants that our development team does a lot of work to bring out those foundation that foundation money and the grant money. So we don't have the member-based group, which means a lot of times we don't have standing on our own behalf to bring a case. So the first thing we need then is our clients. And we do this all the time. We'll work with other environmental groups that are member-based groups. In this case, we worked with Environmental Defense. We worked with the North Carolina chapter of the Sierra Club. We worked with a group called Environment North Carolina. And those were our three clients. They all had members in the affected regions where these power plants are that were going to be affected by the fact that these plants did not have any controls on them. So that was our key hook for standing. So those are our clients as we go forward with this case. And in the district court level, and then in the Court of Appeals level, it's primarily a Southern Environmental Law Center case. We're working on it day in, day out. It's myself, a senior attorney named Bland Holman, and then another, our deputy director, Jeff Gleason, sort of the three people that are working on this case day in, day out. And we're in contact with our clients, but they're not as daily involved in the practice of the litigation of this case. When the gist of how this case was, we lost along with EPA in the district court, and we lost along with EPA in the Court of Appeals. When we lost in the Court of Appeals, EPA did something really interesting. They promulgated, or they proposed a regulation. They haven't promulgated it yet. They haven't finalized it yet. But they proposed a regulation to say, yeah, we think this Fourth Circuit decision ruling against us is really bad, and we don't like it, but it's the rule in the Fourth Circuit, and so we're going to propose a rule to nationalize it just for consistency's sake, and this will be the rule for the nation going forward on the NSR program. What this really is an indication of EPA throughout this whole case being pulled in two directions. On the one hand, you've got the folks that are trying to finish these enforcement cases, sort of the guys you deal with on the ground level. On the other hand, you have sort of the political winds that are pushing this case to that are trying to move in a completely different direction on NSR, are pushing several different regulations that are rolling back the very protections that we're trying to enforce here. So EPA is sort of getting pulled in both directions throughout this whole case. When they lose in the Fourth Circuit, they seem to be siding with industry in nationalizing this losing decision. At that time, we thought this is a nationally important case. It's obviously hugely important for our region, much of which is in the Fourth Circuit, and we thought it was important to seek Supreme Court review and file a cert petition. So we talked with our client, the main client here being Environmental Defense, and Vicki Patton, who's a lawyer there, and she was very gung-ho about seeking cert as well. And then the key thing at this point is we needed to get Supreme Court counsel, and this is where the case really starts to get broader. We could have, in theory, I mean, I'm a member of the Supreme Court Bar, I could, in theory, have drafted a cert petition and done it on my own. But the reality is, it's a specialized enough practice that you really want, and the chances of cert getting granted are minimal. I mean, they take just a tiny fraction of the thousands and thousands of cert petitions they receive every year. So you want to sort of tee your case up the best possible way. So the first thing we did was we went to find a Supreme Court counsel to help us with this. And we got this guy, Sean Donahue, who has a sort of a boutique environmental law practice, appellate practice. He's also, or boutique appellate practice, he's also an environmental law professor at WNL on the other side of the mountain. And he used to be in the appellate section of the Environmental and Natural Resources Division at the Justice Department. And he's also happened to have clerked for Justice Stevens. I think he also clerked for Justice Ginsburg when she was on the D.C. Circuit. So he's a person who knows the Supreme Court certainly better than I do. And he's willing to take the job. That was the other thing. At this point, EPA was not interested in seeking cert. We were looking at going it alone. There weren't a lot of folks that thought we had a great shot at doing it. So the fact that Sean was willing to help us on this when he's got a lot of other stuff going on was great. We're happy to have his help. So Sean came on to join our team to help us draft the cert petition. And the first thing we do is we go up and meet with the Solicitor General's office to try to convince them to, if they're not going to join us in filing a cert petition, to at least not oppose us. And we have a pretty good meeting with them. It's if you haven't been to the Justice Department, by the way, recently, it is dramatically post-9/11ized, for lack of a better term. You walk in now, it's, you know, you have to be on the list, and you have to give your name and your ID and all that kind of stuff. But even before you get into the building, they have these chambers. They're like something out of like a game show or something. These like the silence booths. You go into this little glass-walled chamber. It closes around you. It plays classical music for about 30 seconds while you just stand in there. And what it's doing is it's sniffing you for any residue of explosive devices. So it says with the new, you're just sort of sitting there listening to Brahms or whatever and being sniffed for bombs. It's the new brave new world of going into the Justice Department. But anyway, so we get through the bomb sniffing machine and we make it into the sort of the inner sanctum. We go up and meet with the Solicitor General's office, and we get the sense pretty quickly that they're not going to join us, and maybe they won't oppose us. We're not really sure. So sure enough, we go ahead, we file our cert petition, which was initially due the day after Thanksgiving. We asked for an extension, and those fun-loving justices said, sure, we'll give you an extension. It's now due the Monday after Christmas. So either way, they were determined to ruin one of our holidays, and ended up being Christmas. So we finish our cert petition, we file it, and sure enough, the United States and Duke Energy file in opposition. Duke Energy saying that the Fourth Circuit's decision is right. EPA saying, well, maybe the Fourth Circuit was wrong, but this isn't that important of a case, and we can fix this through rulemaking. Rulemaking, remember, in this situation is really rollbacks. So Supreme Court, it's not worth your time. You've got a lot more important cases to take. Don't worry about it. Well, against dramatic odds, the Supreme Court takes the case. In fact, this is only the second time since that in modern environmental law where the Supreme Court has taken a case from a petitioner where the petitioner is solely an environmental group. You know, normally these environmental cases get teed up with an environmental group with an attorney general's office from a state or a coalition of states or the Justice Department or somebody like that. So this is only the second time, the first time being 1971, Sierra Club versus Morton. And it's also really rare that we get it when the Solicitor General's office is opposing us. Solicitor General, you may have heard that, you know, gets nicknamed as the 10th Justice because has such immense powers of persuasion on the kind of cases that the court takes and can have a real influence on the outcome of the Supreme Court jurisprudence. Well, maybe this is a change in the Roberts Court because he seems really interested in environmental cases. And at least in this term, he seems really interested in environmental cases that the United States doesn't want him to hear. The two big environmental cases that were taken were our case, where the Solicitor General opposed us, and the global warming case you may have heard something about, Massachusetts v. EPA, where again the Solicitor General opposed the cert being granted. So in both these cases where this 10th Justice is saying, don't bother, the Supreme Court is saying, no, we'd rather bother. Anyway, so that's the case as it gets to the Supreme Court. We spend the summer working on our briefs and getting this case all ready. Finally get to November 1st, the day of oral argument, and Sean is going to be the one that gets to argue it for us. and the rest of us will be in there anxious for him. He, by the way, was apparently really, really nervous about this, but did an amazing job. I couldn't tell that he was nervous. Found that afterward, he said he didn't sleep a wink the night of the oral argument, but he looked fresh to me, at least there at the podium. The morning of the case was just, it was really fun. If you've never been to the Supreme Court, it's definitely the kind of thing, you see a case on the docket that's interesting to you, I highly recommend driving up to go check out an oral argument. You know, I was getting dressed to get at the courtroom. I'm listening to NPR, and Nina Totenberg is doing a story on our case, and sort of getting ramped up. And I get in the car, and I get to the Supreme Court building, and there's already this long line of people who've lined up are waiting to get in. One was a former intern of ours who's a student at Georgetown. She said she got there about 4 in the morning to make sure she got in. As it turned out, if you weren't there by about 6:10, 6:15, that seemed to be people I talked to who got there by 6 got in. People who got there at 6:30. Didn't make it in. So it's one of those things, you got to get there early if you want to go. So you've got the line of people waiting outside for the regular gallery. We work our way inside into the courtroom, or into the court building, rather. And then there's the lawyer's line of people who are members of the Supreme Court Bar who are also waiting, have been waiting since fairly early in the morning to get in. And then finally you go through all these different security screenings and you get into the courtroom. And you've got 1 hour for oral argument. As the case worked out for us, we split time with the Justice Department. Justice Department opposed us, as you remember, on seeking cert, but once cert was granted, they said, well, we didn't think the Supreme Court should take the case, but as long as you've taken it, yeah, the Fourth Circuit was wrong. So they end up filing briefs, and fairly good briefs, actually. It was nice. We were worried, were they going to be aggressive in their enforcement of this case, or since they opposed us in cert, were they really going to back off pretty aggressively? We didn't know which way they were going to go. Their briefs ended up being strong briefs in support of us, and they... which I hope will be critical to have EPA's strong support in the final legs of this case. Anyway, cert is, all the briefs are filed. Now we've got to figure out how we're going to divide up oral argument time. We have 30 minutes aside. Duke has 30 minutes. We have 30 minutes. At this point, by the way, everyone has got their Supreme Court counsel. We've got Sean Donohue, the Solicitor General, sort of the specialized counsel for the government, and... Duke Energy has hired this guy, Carter Phillips. And just a little story about Carter Phillips. I had heard him before referred to as one of the lions of the Supreme Court bar. He's argued something like 50-some-odd cases before the Supreme Court. It used to be, before John Roberts was on the court, that if you were industry and you had a case in the Supreme Court, you either hired John Roberts or Carter Phillips. And now you hire Carter Phillips because John Roberts is the Chief Justice. He's not available for hire anymore. But I was down in Richmond visiting the judge I used to clerk for, Roger Gregory, on the Fourth Circuit, and I was chatting with him. And like everyone who first hears about the case, or all my friends at least, he said, so are you going to be the one to get to argue it? I said, no, I'm not going to argue and explain. Sean's going to argue and explain the whole concept. You know, it's sort of like a Sherpa. You know, you go hiking in the Appalachians or the Rocky Mountains, you can do that on your own. But if you're going to go to the Himalayas, you better hire a Sherpa. And so Sean Donohue was our Sherpa. In the Himalayas of the Supreme Court. So I sort of give that analogy, to the Sherpa analogy, to Judge Gregory. He's like, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like that guy Carter Phillips. I was like, yeah, that's who the other side hired. He's their Sherpa. So we knew we were going against a pretty formidable force. We split our argument time. We took 15 minutes. We gave 15 minutes to the government, and Carter Phillips had 30 minutes. As it broke up, we started with Sean and our side went first, then the government went, then 30 minutes for Carter Phillips, and then we saved a couple of minutes for rebuttal. And this is something we'd worked on in moot courts, is the court is incredibly, it's the hottest bench you'll ever see. I mean, Sean got his first question less than 2 sentences into his opening, and for an hour, it was just boom, 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 boom. So one thing we had worked on, we knew we really wanted to save those 3 minutes or whatever we could get for rebuttal, but it's really hard to sit down because you can say to the court, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, and a justice will say, that's great, but I just want to know and go off with another question. And you'll lose your rebuttal time. You'll just talk through all of your remaining time asking questions. So we had worked, Richard Lazarus, who's a professor at Georgetown, had recommended to Sean, he said, you need to just sit down when your time is running out, you see that white light come on, marking that you've saved time for rebuttal. You need just to get yourself in your chair. Just say, thank you, I'll save the remainder of my time, and sit down, and don't wait for any invitation to sit down. So he's up there. He's trying to get his way to sit down. They keep asking him questions. Bland Holman, who's a senior attorney with Southern Environmental Law Center, is sitting counsel seat next to him, passes him a note that just says in big letters, "Sit down," and sort of goes psst, psst. And eventually Sean gets himself in that seat, and we've got 3 minutes for rebuttal, which I think proved really critical in this case. There were a couple of one reason it proved critical is on the meaning of these regulations. Duke threw up a new regulation that they said used the phrase emission rates. It's not a regulation they had cited before. And they said emission rates means hourly rate of emissions, not this actual annual tons per year test. So if the regulation uses emission rates, therefore the test must be this hourly test that we've been talking about. And we pointed out first that that's a regulation that doesn't apply to this case. It applies to a different section of the Code of Federal Regulations. And Scalia, in rebuttal, sort of jumped on this point and said to Sean, "I know you say this doesn't apply, but if it did apply, you have to admit they've got you there." And Sean said, "No, I don't give them that." And he pointed out that emission rate, commonsensically, can be an hourly rate. It doesn't have to be an annually rate. And in this particular case, for NSR, emission rate is defined as tons per year, not hourly rate. And Scalia said, "It defines it as tons per year. Where does it do that?" And Sean said, "Well, if you look through the regulation over and over again, there are several points where it uses the phrase emission rate, and then it uses the phrase tons per year, and it uses them together so that obviously emission rate means ton per year." There's not a section, by the way, where that defines it verbatim like that, but the inference is pretty easily drawn. And Scalia sort of said, okay, and sort of rocked back, didn't ask another question, and that was the final moment in this hour-long oral argument.